Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merritt Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Top Shelf. I missed you guys, and I'm thrilled to be back once again to talk about a novel you must add to your TBR list. I know you have that nightstand out there, and you want to add one more thing to it, but you must add The Fall of Lisa Bello. And I'm delighted to say that we have author Susan Paribou with us for this podcast. So before I introduce Susan, let me give you some background about the book. The Fall of Lisa Bello is the story of a family coming to grips with an absolutely jarring event, a near kidnapping. Middle school student Meredith and her classmate Lisa are in the wrong place at the wrong time when a robbery occurs in the local sandwich shop. One of the girls is abducted in broad daylight, and a fellow student and witness to the crime has to cope with this tragedy. The question in this book is, what happens to the girl left behind, and how does her family process this incredible event? We'll discuss this in short order as soon as I tell you about the person behind this remarkable book, author Susan Paribou. So Susan is the author of the short story collections, Who Was I Supposed to Be?, and Why They Run the Way They Do, and the novel The Broken Places. This recent novel today that we'll be discussing is The Fall of Lisa Bello. Susan's fiction has been anthologized in Best American Short Stories, Pushcart Prize Stories, and New Stories from the South. And she's appeared in numerous magazines, including One Story, Glimmer Train, The Iowa Review, The Missouri Review, and The Sun. She is a writer in residence and professor of English at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And she holds an MFA from the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville. So having said all that, I have the pleasure of welcoming author Susan Paribou. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
How is the weather out there in PA? It's about 40 degrees here, and I honestly, I'm probably the only one that couldn't be happier about it.
It got cold here in a hurry, too fast for me. My body has not adjusted yet, so it seems like winter already, and it's about 47 degrees or something. Yeah. So
it's good hair weather, as we say in New York. And I have to be honest that after I read the book, The Fall of Lisa Bello, the first thing I did was I called my sister, and I said, you have to read it. And then the second thing I did was went back and found all your other books. And while I was doing all my background research, and I thought, I wonder if she'd like to do this podcast with Top Shelf, I came across a website that said you were the first woman to play NCAA baseball and that there's a plaque for you in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. You're the first collegiate female baseball player in history, and that is amazing.
It is correct that I was the first woman to play NCAA baseball. It happened sort of accidentally. I went to a little school in St. Louis called Webster University that had a very young sports program. There was no softball team, and I had grown up playing both baseball and softball. I really wanted to play college sports, so I went out for the team, and I did not do it with the knowledge that no one had done this thing before or that it was any kind of groundbreaking or pioneering moment. Certainly, I just wanted to play baseball. And so I found out about that actually much later, a couple years later. So it was a big surprise to find out that there was any notoriety attached to it whatsoever. And the Hall of Fame thing, I'll just tell you quickly. Sometimes people erroneously think that, like, I've been enshrined in the Hall of Fame or that I'm a member of the, you know, that this is, you know, people get a little bit carried away with this sometimes. The truth is that there's a women in baseball exhibit in the Hall of Fame, and that for a while, and it's actually not even the same as it was back when it started, but there was a plaque that had my name on it and that said I was the first woman to play NCAA baseball. And I didn't even know that this existed, this exhibit or this plaque, until my parents went to the Hall of Fame for the first time themselves. My father's a huge baseball fan. They were really excited to go. And they called me from the museum. And my mother was weeping. And they called me and they said, you're in the Hall of Fame. your name is here in the Hall of Fame. And so I had no idea. I mean, you would think that they might call you and tell you. But so this is, years and years ago. This is 25 years ago that this happened. And so the next summer I went myself and I got to meet a bunch of people there and I got to get a backstage tour of the archives.
Oh,
and so
goodness.
It's a big baseball nut. You know, this was like a dream. And I've since kept up with some people there and feel a real connection to the place. And so, again, it was just this accidental, thing that came into my life and that has now stayed around forever, but has given me a lot back that I couldn't have imagined when I was 18 years old going out for the baseball team.
Yeah, no so. Kidding. I mean, that's what a byproduct, huh?
Yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah,
and
really.
In almost every introduction, I have to say.
I know, and I apologize. I don't want to keep bringing that up, but that is, that's amazing.
It's fine.
It's amazing. Yeah. So as I mentioned at the top, all of your accomplishments combined with having a family and teaching full time, and yet we get to this book, The Fall of Lisa Bello. What is the background? How does this story come to you? It was riveting. The narrative is quick. The editing is tight. And it felt like it was just written so effortlessly. How on earth does this story come to you?
That's nice. I appreciate that. I carried the story around for a long time before I wrote it, which is one of the reasons why I hope, I mean, if it worked for you, I think that's part of why it seems effortless, because I think I knew the book and I knew the characters really, really well before I wrote a word of it. Because, as you mentioned, I'm a full-time college professor. I've got a lot of balls in the air. And so I kind of had to wait to write this book until I had some space to write it and some time. And so I carried around these two stories, but for a long time, I thought they were two separate stories. The story of this overprotective, almost obsessively overprotective mother who is torn between these kind of fits of crazy desire to take care of her children, and also this resignation that she'll never really be able to do so as much as she wants to. And then the story of this girl left behind. And for a few years, these stories existed on separate tracks in my mind, and I wasn't sure if they were short stories that I might eventually write one day or what they were. And I wasn't sure if they were funny or if they were serious, and I didn't quite know how to make sense of either of them. And then one day they kind of crossed. They just in my head they crossed paths, and I realized that the mother that I had been carrying around was the mother of the girl I had been carrying around. And once I made that connection, then they folded together. And again, I came upon a time in my life when, due to circumstances with my job, I had a space where I could sit down and write the book. And so I sat down and I wrote the book actually very quickly, because one, I knew that I wouldn't have that space for long, right. But two, I already had I had the story in my head. I had the characters really deeply in my consciousness, and so it was. I won't say it was easy, but it came together very quickly.
So the two characters, I'm assuming one is Meredith and one was Claire.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So you had the Claire piece of it, and then you have the Meredith piece of it. And then did you always know that Meredith would be this victim in this? Oh, so you, right.
And that's, yeah. So I had this idea of what it would be like to be the person who was not taken. And for a long time when I had this idea, I wasn't even sure that the person was a child. I toyed with the idea of like, what if you were an adult and this happened and someone was taken and you were not, so it was really just a conceptual thing that just became more and more specific the more that I thought about it until I got to Meredith.
That's amazing. And Meredith really does. She jumps off the page at us. She is a living, breathing middle school student. Her thoughts and those of her classmates are incredibly accurate. I mean, I had one. So I had two. So how did you get Meredith's voice in such a, how you captured it so vividly?
Thanks. I feel very comfortable writing characters of that age. Sometimes I think that I feel a little too comfortable, like maybe I'm only a very small step away from being 13 years old myself. A lot of my short stories are about kids who are between the ages of 12 and 16. It's just it's a brain that I feel like I still have access to. And part of it has to do with my own kids, but a large part of it honestly has to do with me, that I feel like I'm never very far from seeing the world as a 14-year-old, and that makes Meredith's psyche pretty easy to access for me.
I mean, it's like I said, it's accurately done, and I do love that relationship between Meredith and her brother. Again, completely accurate. I also have a son and a daughter, and their relationship is filled with these things that they share and have shared as siblings that are completely independent of me and my husband. So it gives me joy to see them behaving that way, and I felt the same way getting into this peak of Meredith and Evan with their little inside jokes and the things that they share together that are exclusive of us as parents.
And it's wonderful as a parent to watch that and to feel that juxtaposition of I'm left out, but I love the fact that I'm left out, right?
It's
I
a
love
great
the fact
feeling.
That they have that without me. Yeah, so I have the same. I have an older son and a younger daughter, and they have a very... they are not my characters at all.
Of course, right.
But I certainly... I love that connection, and I was happy to be able to write about it.
Right. So my kids are in their 20s, young 20s, but when I hear them giggling in the next room, you know, it just, it's a joyful thing. And like you said, it's sort of bittersweet because you're like, oh man, I wonder what they're talking about. But I'm like, oh, thank goodness. So seeing that with Meredith and Evan so accurately portrayed was a nice little, it was a gift in a sense, because you really feel like you're in the story. You're observing these people. But I want to make our way over to Meredith's mother, Claire. In your book tours and interviews, do readers make any observations about Claire? What do they say about her?
Yeah, people talk about Claire more than any character, which probably isn't surprising to you. And I know that she resonated with you. And what's interesting is that people feel a lot of different ways about her, and some readers really can't stand her. I mean, really react with, I would say, almost a kind of hostility toward the way that she parents, toward her inner thoughts about parenting, and toward some of her actions in the book. Not even necessarily the ones that are the most kind of outrageously overprotective, but even just her inability to engage with her daughter in the moments that the readers feel like she should be able to engage, that causes some readers to really dislike her, not to feel like, oh boy, I've been there, or oh, that's tough to feel as a parent, but like, what's wrong with her?
Right.
And so that's been fascinating to me. That was unexpected. I didn't see that coming, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I look at that reaction as sort of a Monday morning quarterback, right? You can say, I would do this differently, but when you are in the heat of that moment and you're not only circling your own emotions, but you're circling the emotions of your child and what the best thing to do is, you know, I often say, I've never had a 16-year-old before. I've never had a 17-year-old right. before. So it's
I don't know what I'm doing.
I have no idea what I'm doing. So I, not only did I sympathize with Claire, but I empathized with Claire.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's right on the money. There are certain things that she says when she's sitting on the bleachers and she's watching Evan's game. You know, is it still in the top of the third inning? No one admits to that. Even the moms who sit there and the dads who sit there and say, you know, my kid, I'm going to that game. But that when that top of the third inning grind, you say it, Claire says it. I know people feel it and they will never admit it. And that's what I appreciated about Claire. She is owning up to her stuff. And I completely thought that that was so honest. I love when she, earlier in the book, when Claire is talking about trying to protect her children, among all the other things that we hear from Claire, which is just, she's like a breath of fresh air. But again, we never say these things out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And we're listening to Claire's inner thoughts, and you can Monday morning quarterback all you want, but you have no idea what you're going to do until you're in that situation.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just shocked when I became a parent and started thinking some of these things.
Right.
It never occurred to me that I would go to some of the places that I went. And that's where that character came from. Absolutely. Was just, you know, all those thoughts that you have when you realize that the world is out there and you are the thing that stands between the world and your child, and you will go to any lengths, you know, and that all was a real eye opener.
Yeah. And that's what I think makes this an excellent book discussion book, because there will be such visceral reaction to Claire. The honesty of her thoughts are, it's so refreshing. It's a little disconcerting. And I think that that's what would make a perfect book discussion for this, in this case, for The Fall of Lisa Bello. Now, Meredith's parents, Claire and Mark, they're dentists, which is also a great choice. I cannot recall the last time I read about a dentist, let alone a husband and wife team. And Claire, she wields her profession like a superpower, especially advantageously, because she's kind of able to get back at that bully Logan in probably a way that really sets people off.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, we all think about it, right? We all think, I shouldn't say we all.
If you think about it.
Exactly.
At least we know you and I think
right,
about it.
Right, right. And you're faced in that situation. Who doesn't wish that you could get that instant karma to happen for whatever that situation is? If you know someone's giving your kid shade or throwing some, whatever it is, being a bully, you know, you say to yourself, man, that's going to come back. I just hope I'm there to see it.
Right.
And Claire just has the advantage of having a couple of dental instruments that are right at her hand to make sure but I also love that she tells Mark about it. She says to her husband, look, I did this. And Mark is like, are you kidding me? Which is probably the reaction of other readers. I was more sympathetic to her. Because when you go into mama bear mode, it's hard to not sympathize with her. Again, we think these things out, but we don't really say them out loud. Although we're pretty much doing it right now.
We are copping to it right now.
I'm drawn to that the astute characterizations of Mark and Claire's relationship, especially the scene where we talked about this before, where Claire is at the barbecue with her girlfriends, and her girlfriends start talking about, you know, all the faults and flaws of their husbands, and, oh, you know what he did last night? We've all been at that barbecue. We've all been at those dinners where these conversations take place, and they talk about how great Mark is. He can't do anything wrong. Great things about Mark. I mean, talking up, you know, you hold up a mirror to your marriage. It's brilliantly done. It's accurate. The feeling the reader gets, or what I got is all the feels, as the kids say today. I felt these things in my gut. You were sitting at that barbecue doing exactly the same thing.
I'm glad. And what I appreciate about the way that you read the book and the way that you're talking about the book is that I think of this book as a family drama. We haven't talked about Lisa Bello yet, even though she's
that's
the title.
My next question.
And she, you know, I mean, that but I really appreciate when readers are able to understand that at its heart, and as you introduced it, this is a book about a family coping with something that happened to the title character. This is not a book about the title character. And so I'm really glad that's what spoke to you in the book. That's what was interesting to me while I was writing it.
It was almost, which goes right into my next question. We're talking about these familial relationships, and again, that is the focus of the book, that the Lisa Bello piece of the story, the title character, while her situation is horrifying, it's not the main focus. How hard was this you must have had to go back and forth, or I don't even know how to ask this question, to structure this while you're writing. How mm-hmm. I don't know how you sort of manifested it to flow the way it flows.
Again, part of the advantage I had was that I knew the characters so well, I knew the story well, and so the book unfolded itself for me, almost. Not that I didn't, I obviously there were decisions that I had to make, and the book is told in alternating point of view chapters between Meredith and Claire, and I had to think about what scene went where, and I had to think about how Lisa's world and Meredith's imagination about Lisa's world would be folded in and how significantly it would be folded in. So, it was making all those choices, but because I knew that the book was a character-driven novel and because I cared so deeply about these characters, those things fell into place behind the character motivations. And so it was not the kind of book that I, every few pages, was thinking, well, now what's going to happen? Well, I wonder what happened next. That wasn't this. This was a book that just unfolded as the characters experienced it.
Right. So it's like an everyday, I don't want to say it's an everyday life, but there are experiences that families have and how they deal with the aftermath. Mm-hmm. And it's not important per se what happens to Lisa, it's sort of how this family is dealing with their reaction to what happens to
Correct.
Lisa. And right, so
that's my feeling. But I will tell you that the other surprise of the book for me, besides the reaction to Claire, is that there are many, many readers who cannot stand the fact that the book does not have a satisfying conclusion to its central question.
Right, I got it.
To me, because the book was so much about the family, I didn't feel that kind of conclusion was necessary, and I felt like it might detract from the book.
Right.
But I underestimated the desire for closure among many readers. And so that's been really interesting to see, too, that people are always asking me, spoiler alert, we don't know at the end of the book what happens to Lisa. I don't mind that people know that going into the book. But people are always asking me at readings, what happened to her? What did happen? And that's difficult for some people to not know fully at the end.
Right. It is tricky, but for me, the ending, that's that last sentence, I'm ready. Meredith says, I'm ready. And I thought that was just... that says everything about, it's hopeful. There's mm-hmm. hope. They're going to get through it, in my opinion. So the worst question you're going to get during this interview, you thought the baseball question was bad. So having said all that, you're probably still doing the book tour for this. Any other thoughts? Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you, but you answered that already, whether or not these two pieces were going to be short stories, but then they wound up folding into the one novel. Do you have any little things coming into your head about what you might be doing next? Writing anything or...
Yeah, that's the worst question.
It
You're
is.
Right.
I apologize.
It's much worse than the baseball question. Yeah. No, it's okay. I don't mind at all. It's okay. It's a logical question. I do. And because of the way I write, because I have a long lead time before I sit down and really can focus on a project, I'm kind of in that phase right now. I'm kind of in the phase where things are coming together. I mean, I've got a book that I want to write, and it's putting itself together in my head when I walk the dog, when I drive the kids to school, and, you know, so it's constructing itself, and I'm looking forward to having some time to let it out.
So if I were driving behind you in my minivan or my Jeep, and I'd say, oh my gosh, that's Susan up there. I wonder what she's thinking about right now. I would try to be like, Susan, toot toot. Go to it, girl. Go to it. Is there any place that readers can find you, what you're working on, if you're writing on essay, any essays? Where did I find this one piece where mothers bully back? There was something you wrote in the New York Times, which was amazing, a really wonderful.
speaks to exactly what we're talking
about. Yes, I know.
Which is in terms of the things that you don't necessarily want to admit that you're thinking about the children who are picking on your children.
Right.
So, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there a place, and I actually also loved this Brooklyn Rail piece that you did with Weston Cutter. I think that was sometime last year. What a great article. I mean, that
he's
was
a great interviewer.
Yeah, he really, holy cow. I pale in comparison, truly. But this was a great piece. Where can readers sort of find anything that sort of these kind of materials? Is there one, a repository for all that? Do you have a website or
something? There is not a repository at this point for it. I do have an author page on Facebook, and I do Twitter at the urging of my publicists. But I don't, there's no webpage, but those things are, most of those things are out there online, and you can find them.
Okay, great. And it's funny that you say that about Twitter, because we do the library community does the hashtag Friday Reads.
And I am familiar with that. It's fantastic.
And so I had finished the book on the believe it or not, Thursday night, and I went to go to sleep, and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't wait for the Friday reads, because I have to tell everybody that I'm reading The Fall of Lisa Bellow, and they have to read it. And then I said, oh, I wonder if she's got, you know, she's on there, if she's got a Twitter handle, and you did. And I thought, holy smoke. So it's a nice forum. It's good that you're on Twitter, because it's helpful to the authors, I think, to know that people are out there sort of reading, and libraries really push
it
their authors.
Great.
We really try to get behind the books that we love and the authors that we love as well.
There's a great book community on Twitter. I mean, Twitter is a lot of things that will make you crazy, but there's some good stuff on there. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. So yay, Friday Reads, and guys, go out and get this book. Lisa, I can't thank you enough for speaking with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. All you listeners out there, please know you can get your copy of The Fall of Lisa Bellow at Merrick Library. And it's also available as an ebook and an audiobook through the Libby app. That's all the time that we have for today. Listeners, I cannot thank you enough for spending your time with me today. You can follow the Top Shelf Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. Don't forget to check out the Merrick Library website at merricklibrary.org. It's pretty fabulous. Special thanks, as always, to Merrick Library Director Ellen Firer and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. Until the next time, remember, please keep us on your top shelf.